Nightlife. Bite-sized history.
During World War II, more than 4,000 Japanese civilians were interned in Australia, while in the United States, the figure was more than 110,000. In Australia, the Japanese interns were kept in camps, usually far from capital cities, surrounded by barbed wire fences, and with the vast majority of Japanese interns being sent back to Japan, not a lot of those interns got a chance to tell their stories here in Australia. But in both the United States and to a lesser extent here, many photographs were taken of life in an internment camp, and some of those photos have just gone on display at the National Maritime Museum in Sydney. These photos also tell the story of the shared experiences of war in both the US and Australia, and even include some photos taken specifically to convince the Americans that we here in Australia were pulling our weight when it came to the war effort. Richard Wood's the manager of USA programs with the Australian National Maritime Museum, and he put the exhibition together. He's here to tell us some of the stories behind these photographs. Richard, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks, Philip. Thanks for asking me.
Yeah, now where were these camps across Australia?
In Australia, the ones that we have the photographic documentation of were a lot in the Riverland in South Australia at near Barmara. A particular camp called Loveday Camp is where a lot of the Japanese internees were.
Who got put in them?
Basically anyone of Japanese ancestry, whether born overseas or
even born here.
That's right.
Hmm.
Same applied in the US.
So that's right. You could have regarded this your home.
Many people,
but because
did.
because of the look of you, you were put in these camps.
You were, and I think particularly in the US, it was to appease the general population. Mm-hmm. After the attack on Pearl Harbor, they were quite fearful of anyone of Japanese ancestry. In Australia, we included in our internment camps people of Japanese ancestry from the Southwest Pacific who were evacuated out of that area as the Japanese moved in.
So out of the frying pan into the fire.
Just about.
As it were. So what was life like in them? Must have been a very expensive logistical exercise, you would have thought.
Well, we've got pictures, from the Australian point of view, by a photographer called Keith Cullen. They were oftentimes transited through the Hay internment camp, which had been established early on in the war for German-Italian internees. And they would catch a train from there. They were then loaded onto, we've got a great photo of all these people getting on board with their baggage onto a steam paddle boat to go up the Murray River to Loveday and Barmara. When they got there, it was very basically a thrown-together place surrounded by barbed wire with very basic cabin accommodation. Mm-hmm. In Australia, it was corrugated metal. In America, it looked like it was timber.
Mm-hmm.
Little huts, people were assigned to the huts. In America, it was more whole families were interned. In Australia, they tended to be more individuals because that's the way the Japanese population was in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
They were put to work to both provide food and keep the camp working, but also to provide food and to do work for the war effort and the home front. And in Australia, that included at the Loveday Camp milling timber.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great photo of people using a celery planter to plant an experimental crop that was destined or was supposed to replace rubber because rubber supplies had been cut off from Asia.
Mm-hmm.
They continued to live their own cultural life from the point of view of trying to prepare food that was familiar to them. There's a great photo of a Japanese gentleman standing in front of a hut and a whole row of Japanese shoes out the front, and the photographer Cullen has written Japanese clogs in front of a hut. The Japanese don't wear shoes inside. So these were the observations of a photographer who was also in the army, who was part of the battalion that was looking after the camp. They also made their own entranceway to their camp, and that's made of bamboo. It was called Camp 14, and they planted a Japanese garden there. And we've even got quite a poignant image of the first Japanese grave at Loveday, and that has a beer bottle with incense burning in it and the photographer's description of the ceremony.
Hadley Keith Cullen's an interesting fella in a way, isn't he? He went on to be an actor of some renown.
He did. He f- featured in quite a few quite well-known Australian films, and was also renowned as Deadly Earnest, I think on Network 10, introduced the Friday night spooky movies.
Mm-hmm. The bulk of the photos of the exhibition are by an American photographer, Dorothea Lange, who's well-known in the US.
She is, so she's quite well-known here too. She was one of the first photojournalists. So you've got the first sort of photographs being in newspapers in about 1905, and then magazines started to be produced that were photographic magazines. Mm-hmm. And Lange had a studio, was a portrait photographer. She lived in Berkeley, California. She had a studio in San Francisco. But she was employed by the Farm Administration in the Roosevelt years to look at the resettlement of what they referred to as migrant workers. These mm-hmm. weren't immigrants from other countries. These were people evacuating from the Dust Bowl in the centre and east of the United States. And she gained notoriety for her sort of unvarnished pictures of what the Depression was doing to Americans. And we've got five of those original photographs there that include something called Death in a Doorway and a very famous photograph of a woman referred to as an immigrant pea picker and her family. She just sold the tires of her car to buy food. The pea crop had failed because of a frost. And she has, I think, four or five children and is homeless. Mm. And this was a very common scene in California where people rushed during the Depression to try and get work, and it didn't always work out for them.
Mm. I'm talking with Richard Wood from the National Maritime Museum about an exhibition of photographs of Japanese internment camps in the USA, also in Australia as well. The Office of War Information in America wasn't very happy with Dorothea Lange's work, was it?
No, as I said, they were fairly raw images. Yeah. She was a photojournalist, and she was quite a social activist, and she took photos as they were. So there are pictures of Japanese being herded together by armed guards. We haven't got an armed guard photo in the exhibition, but
although they were there, were they?
They were there. They were armed guards. Mm. It was forced under an executive order from the president.
Yeah.
And it follows the process from, you know, registering in the street, all your bags being sort of thrown into the back of a truck, being put into a processing centre. There's a very poignant photo of an old gentleman sitting on the end of a bed, mm. another one of an old gentleman being handed a tag, and then into this quite desolate camp called Manzanar in the middle of California, where they would live for the next 3.5 years.
Mm. What about the businesses and homes that they had left behind? What happened to them?
Well, the immediate reaction is a great photo there with a person's business front, shop front, with I am an American plastered across the front of it, reacting to the idea that as soon as Pearl Harbor happened, Japanese were looked upon very askance.
Yeah.
They sold up very quickly, and some people lost their property. They basically could take what they could carry with them. Some of them drove themselves to the camp.
Right.
But they were always very...
But their properties weren't confiscated.
They weren't confiscated, but they tended to sell them up quickly to get some money,
right?
And to not abandon them. Mm. Whole families went there, and one photographer, a man called Toyo Miyataki, who had a studio in Los Angeles, had been a photographer there since the early 30s, late 20s. His family was sent to Manzanar, his son, daughter, wife. He smuggled in a camera lens and some film holders because they weren't allowed to take photos inside an internment camp.
So there are some Miyataki photographs.
We've got 14 or 15 Miyataki photos. What happened was he had been trained by Edward Weston, who's quite a famous American photographer, and Ansel Adams, and word got out. Well, first of all, he went to the chief of the internment camp and said, "Can I take photos?" Once the camera had been discovered. And he said, "Okay, because you've got this background, you're a professional photographer, what you can do is set up the photo, set up the shot, but a non-Japanese person has to push the shutter, which means you're not taking the photo." Well, this lasted for a little while until the non-Japanese person got really bored of Miyataki setting up beautiful photographs. And so then he was allowed to set up a studio. And his photographs are beautifully composed. He's a pictorialist in style. And it's towards the 1944 when people had established a way of life there. It's not Lange's photos that are very much here you go into camp.
Mm.
And then we move on to general warfront photography. So the role of women in industry, rationing, etc., both in America and Australia. People working in shipyards in America, women working in shipyards, people working in munitions, women working in munitions in Australia.
Mm. One of the Australian contributors was Jim Fitzpatrick. Now, he was charged with basically taking photos to show to Americans that Australia was doing its bit in the war. Why do we feel that we had to do that?
Towards the end of the war, 1944-45, America felt that it was carrying the entire war burden. Mm-hmm. So the Australian Office of Information in New York requested photographs that depicted a country town at war. Uh-huh. So the town of Druin in Victoria was chosen.
Oh, yeah.
And this series of photographs by Jim Fitzpatrick, who was actually a frontline photographer. He'd been in New Guinea.
Mm.
And they're very Norman Rockwellian. It's an American vision of what an Australian town would be. And there's a...
Druin, but the fact is Druin wasn't at war.
It wasn't really, no. But the war, each of these photos has a backstory about the war. So right. Okay. The postie has a son in a prisoner of war camp.
Okay.
The person getting the letter has a husband in the military. There's an 83-year-old lady digging a grave because there are no men to dig graves, and she likes it.
Mm. Yes, that's a marvellous photo of the woman digging a grave. Do those photos get shown in America or not?
The Australian series, yeah. Not that I'm aware of. They were published for the magazine that was distributed by our information officers. The original prints were found in the early 80s and sent to Australia. Right. And they're now in the collection of the National Library.
Right. You're also involved in an education program to mark the 75th anniversary of the war in the Pacific. You started this a couple of years ago to mark the anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And this involves bringing together students from schools in Japan, Australia and the US. This would be interesting because there's been a debate for a while, hasn't there, about different perceptions of the war, particularly in Japan, where there's been accusations that the Japanese have been involved in papering over things and trying to sanitize their history and so on. I mean, I think some of this is exaggerated, but what's been your experience?
It's interesting. We've only been able to recruit private schools in Japan because World War II isn't part of the high school curriculum for the general population.
It's funny, isn't it?
But the perspectives we've found, and the students have looked at battles of World War II. Last year it was the home front, and this year it's secrets and spies.
Hmm.
Next year it's the coming of peace. In America, they are quite parochial. They're almost not aware of World War II to a lesser or greater extent, or Australia's involvement, or the fact that there were more than a million Americans came through Australia during World War II.
Mm.
Australian students seem more aware of World War II, and the students are much more aware than we might think they would be given the lack of reconciliation of Japan's role in the war. And they seek out witnesses to war, survivors of World War II. It's still quite a local point of view, but it is what we recently had a letter from one school in Sendai that said, thank you for the program. It's allowed us to open up and converse with something that is really quite a taboo subject in Japan.
Mm.
This year, and each year we choose a student from each country. They become our peace ambassadors and they go and visit World War II sites. The first year it was to Pearl Harbor. Last year it was to Cowra and Canberra and Sydney. This year they're going to Tokyo and Hiroshima.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting as a nation comes to terms with its past. It's always an interesting process. Fascinating. All right, the exhibition's on at the Australian National Maritime Museum if you're elsewhere in the country and having to lob through. Richard Wood's been my guest, the creative producer and manager of the USA programs with the museum. Richard, terrific to have your time. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Philip.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.